Our favorite auto gurus are back to answer your car, truck, SUV, hybrid, and station wagon questions. Tomorrow is the vernal equinox, the official first day of spring. But you probably still have snow tires on your car, and your car's interior is a gritty mess. After all, there's a chance of more snow in the forecast. So does the mud and the muck, not to mention this spell of cold weather, have you down and out? Are you dreaming of a shiny new car, or at least a clean one? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll talk about some of the new cars out there. We'll get spring car maintenance tips, news from the auto world, and thoughts on leasing versus buying. What questions do you have for Jamie Page Deaton of U.S. News & World Report and John Paul from AAA? Main calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Do you ever wonder what kind of damage a pothole can do to your car? How do you know when is the right time to get your wheels aligned or to switch out your snow tires? Today, two of our favorite automobile experts are here to answer your car questions of all sorts. Jamie Page Deaton is automotive editor for U.S. News & World Report. John Paul is a master mechanic and spokesperson for AAA Northeast. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you in the market for a new car? Do you have questions about how to make your current car last a few more miles? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to both of you. I'll start, as I always do, asking what you've been driving. John Paul, what have you gotten from the cool pool that you and Jamie Page Deaton get to choose from every week or every 2 weeks?
Well, I wish it was just that easy sometimes, but I've been driving kind of a weird variety of SUVs lately, and by weird, one of them, and I've never driven an Alfa Romeo before, but I was a little surprised that the first one that I would drive would be an SUV, and it was the Alfa Romeo Stelvio, and it was really kind of a unique vehicle. I was a little critical of the ride. The ride was, especially in our less than perfect New England roads, was a little bit choppy and a little bit hard. The performance from the engine was actually better than I expected it to be. It rode well. Once you kind of get over the idea that you're going to feel every pothole on the road, the handling was superb. It was kind of the well-done, dressed-up model, so it was very luxurious inside with a lot of added features that could best be described by maybe an Italian clothing manufacturer more than me. But it uses beautiful leather, nicely trimmed inside, just really kind of a unique vehicle, and certainly something that stood out. And the other SUV I drove, which was hysterical, was the Jeep Grand Cherokee. And everybody, the Grand Cherokee is sort of everybody's darling in New England. It's a great vehicle. It's fun to drive. It for me, it seems like the perfect size SUV. Only this one, Chrysler decided to pull the engine out of the Hellcat and put it in a Jeep Grand Cherokee. They called it the Trackhawk. So they put a 707 horsepower engine under the hood of a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And if you drove it sort of as a normal vehicle, it felt pretty average until you stepped on the accelerator, and then you scared children and animals, and it was ridiculously fast, made a lot of noise, could literally melt the tires off of it if you wanted it to. And should you be concerned about such a thing, fuel economy, when I got in it, the last person who drove it, the fuel economy was about 9.7 miles per gallon.
Whoa.
I got it all the way up to about 15. So with careful driving, I got it up to about 15. But fuel economy is terrible. But it's basically just a crazy vehicle. And somebody said to me, why would anybody build this? And I said, it doesn't make any sense. But on the other hand, I'm really glad they did.
Wow. What about you, Jamie Page Deaton?
I just finished up a week in the Mini Countryman E. So that's a plug-in hybrid Mini Countryman. So it's a little subcompact SUV. It's got all-wheel drive and, you know, plug-in hybrid powertrain that gets you about 12 miles of all-electric range. And I have to be honest, I really didn't like it that much, which is a shame because Mini is one of my favorite brands. The Countryman, though, just doesn't make a lot of sense to me because it's both too big to be a Mini and too small to be a useful SUV. Mm. It just manages to just get the size equation of it absolutely wrong. You know, like John was talking about with the Stelvio, the ride was just way too harsh for this time of year in New England. Really just kind of kidney shaking kind of ride. You felt like you should have been wearing, you know, one of those stabilizing belts as you're going down the road. And then, you know, Minis do tend to be a little bit more expensive than comparably equipped cars. And a lot of the times that to me is completely worth because you're getting such good performance and the interiors tend to be just trimmed out in a little bit nicer materials and things like that. And in this case, this car, the price as tested was just under $40,000. And, you know, for the money, it just didn't feel worth it to me. And I know a lot of money was spent on the powertrain. But to me, you know, for 12 all-electric miles, you could get a Ford C-Max, you could get a Toyota Prius plug-in for a lot less money. You know, it's still $40,000, and it had, you know, manual seats. It didn't have a sunroof. So it was one of those things where it was like, well, I could, you know, I guess you're spending money on the powertrain, but I wasn't feeling it there, wasn't feeling it on the inside. And then it just, you know, the problem with the Countryman just in general and not just the plug-in hybrid is, you know, you buy a Mini so you can drive it like a go-kart. You know, they should have you should have a smile on your face the entire time. And it just wasn't the kind of, you know, Mini that you can throw into corners and really just toss around the road. So it was a little bit of a disappointment. But before that, a couple weeks ago, I had the BMW 740e, which is a plug-in hybrid BMW. This one was a little bit more expensive at $99,000. But there you could actually see where the money went. The powertrain was excellent, excellent power, excellent handling. The different ride modes just soaked up all of the frost heaves, all the potholes. Mm. And it really, you know, I'm not going to spend $99,000 on a car, but if I were, this would be one that I'd have on my list.
Boy, that's a lot of money. Let's talk about something it seems we talk about every time we're together, but is always perpetually in the news. John, you just did a study, AAA just did a study about autonomous vehicles, otherwise known as self-driving cars. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're starting to see more and more acceptance of autonomous vehicles, and I guess it shouldn't be a surprise because we're starting to see more autonomous features in cars, which I think is sort of slowly getting the public more accustomed to taking their hands off the wheel or their eyes off the road for a minute, both which scare me to death, frankly. But we're starting to see more lane departure correction, lane centering, sort of self-driving. We're seeing them in everything from Nissan's now, the new Nissan Rogue has their version of it. We're going to see more and more of that where people can momentarily take their hands off the wheel. And originally, when we did a survey a couple years ago, we saw that the numbers were pretty low. Probably one in four people was probably ready to think about an autonomous vehicle or at least were comfortable being in one. The numbers are still trending in the I'm not completely satisfied, I'm ready to get into a category, but people are starting to get a little bit more accustomed to the idea that there's going to be a lot of features in cars. And one of them that we're starting to see that people are growing to accept pretty quickly is automatic emergency braking, where if someone pulls out in front of you, stops on the brakes quickly, whatever the case is, the system will take over where you're not maybe paying as much of attention. As we start to see more and more of these features starting to be in every kind of car, not just a $99,000 BMW, but in a you know, $20,000 Toyota, I think that's going to lead people to feel more comfortable with the technology. The problem is, and anybody who's driven a newer car with some of these features, when it works good, it works good. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work perfectly all the time. I was driving a late model Chrysler product, and someone in front of me went to turn right at an intersection, got about three quarters of the way around the intersection, and came to a stop. For whatever reason, you and I and every other driver would just sort of jog a little left, go around them. Well, the car interpreted that as a panic stop. It jammed on the brakes, brought the car to a quick stop. I was worried about what was going to happen to the car behind me. If it was paying attention, the driver of that car was paying attention. So the features are there. We haven't figured out how to make them work in New England winters yet. So they are based on using radar and camera systems. So it's still going to be a ways off. In fact, I heard an engineer from Toyota tell me the other day when we were chatting that he's really looking at 2025 before we see true kind of level 4 vehicle autonomy. And level 5 is still way off. That's where you get in the car, you push a button, and it's going to drive you from, you know, Portland to Boston, and you're not going to have to do anything anywhere in between. That's quite a ways off. Level 4 and maybe level 3, where you sort of have to pay attention until the car does it. We're starting to see more acceptance of that, even in light of some recent crashes that have happened with semi-autonomous vehicles.
Jamie, and there's some news today, isn't there?
Oh, yes. So this is the New York Times is reporting that in Tempe, Arizona, overnight, a pedestrian was hit by an Uber autonomous car that was in autonomous mode. And the pedestrian, unfortunately, died as a result of the collision. So this is what they're reporting as the first known pedestrian fatality due to a car in autonomous mode. So it's really kind of interesting. You know, this car, as reported, had a safety driver. So basically a backup driver, even though it was on autonomous mode, and still this, you know, collision happened. And whenever you have anything involving autonomous cars, whether it's, you know, a Tesla crash or this Uber incident, you know, it gets a lot of press. And I think that really does speak to people's kind of fears with autonomous mode. You know, is it going to work? But the other side of it to remember is, you know, we're plenty good at crashing cars on our own. We don't need autonomous systems to help us do that. So I think it's always important to just keep in mind that these systems are interesting, and particularly on new cars now, you know, we're both closer than you think and farther than you think away from fully self-driving cars. I mean, like John mentioned, you can go and you can get the Toyota Safety Sense, you know, those suite of active safety features, which are semi-autonomous, on most new Toyotas standard. And as people get used to them, there's going to be more acceptance. But the most important thing is the human factor. You know, if you're going to not pay attention, even if your car has those features, you're still going to have a world of trouble should an emergency arise.
I wonder if in the at some point in the near future, we're going to have some sort of interim license where people who maybe don't qualify for the driver's license anymore somehow qualify for a license if the car has a certain number of safety features.
You know, that would be interesting, particularly, I think, as you're talking about, you know, the older and aging population. You know, everybody talks about, oh, you're going to have so much more freedom if you have an autonomous car. You can sit there and do work. But just think about the level of independence that older people will have, you know, who might have otherwise had to give up driving if there was a fully autonomous vehicle where they could just go in and say, OK, take me to the grocery store, take me to the doctor's office. But, you know, as John was mentioning, that is really, really far away. At this point, you still need to be a fully in-command driver, you know, waiting to step in at any moment. And that's really where I think you see a lot of problems with these features, where people might say, oh, my car has automatic braking. My car has collision avoidance. It's totally okay for me to start tweeting right now as I'm driving along. And it really just isn't, because those systems can fail at a moment's notice. They're really just there to be kind of, you know, a guardian angel for you on those, you know, those times where you're just unable to pay attention or you just miss it. In a lot of cases, they're just going to help you that little bit, but you still need to be driving as if your car does not have them.
John, in other news, there's the new Hyundai Kia airbag issue. Tell us about that.
Well, there seems to be an airbag issue every time you turn around these days, and Hyundai is been able to separate themselves from the same issues. I don't know that I'm fully familiar with this particular one, but it's just another reason that people really need to stay on top of the recall notices. They can go right to safercar.gov and find out if their car has been recalled by VIN number, so they can put their vehicle identification number in, see if their specific car has been recalled. It's a great way to do it. This latest one with the Hyundai is like all of the other ones. It's just one more time. I believe this one said that there was times that the airbag could go off no apparent reason, and so people need to be aware. And the biggest problem with recalls is more than half the cars that get recalled never go in for service. People just ignore the recall notice and continue driving it. And when it's, you know, something as minor as, oh, they forgot to put a page in the owner's manual, well, that's one thing. But when it's something as important as an issue with airbags, or in the case of recently the Ford Fusion, I guess the steering wheel could become detached.
Jamie, I want to ask you about an article you recently did at U.S. News and World Report, Your Best Cars for Families. What were your criteria, and what did you decide?
Well, this is our awards that we do every year. And this, the best family cars, what we do is we go through each vehicle class and we look for the car that has the best combination of positive reviews from automotive critics, as well as safety, space, reliability, and family-friendly features. And really, the interesting thing there is the family-friendly features, because these are features that in our years of being in test cars that me and some of the other editors have found make their lives either better from families, or, you know, in some cases, you'll have a feature that is supposed to be family friendly and it actually ends up making your life a little bit worse. So these are these are cars that we look at and say, all right, these are models that, you know, no matter what your budget, no matter what kind of car you're looking for, if you've got families, and we're really talking too about families at every stage. So these are good for people with little kids. They're good for people with teenagers who might be handing over the keys for the first time. And they're also good, too, for multi-generational families, because they have features, too, that can help if you have an older relative or a grandparent moving in with your family. And so you can go and see the full list of winners at usnews.com/cars. And these are really just, you know, the best of the best when it comes to, you know, safe, reliable family transport that keeps everybody comfortable, everybody connected, and everybody happy.
And John, before we go to a break, quickly, spring maintenance. I know I had to put some air in one of my tires yesterday after a very cold night. What ought to we be looking at during this transition season?
Well, this is a time where potholes really take, really abuse a car. And that's one of the things. You should get the car into a repair shop as the roads are, you know, maybe starting to get a little bit more clear. But certainly tire damage is one of the big things. A lot of times what happens is we hit a pothole locally, we're driving around, we don't think much of it. Maybe there's a little vibration in the car we haven't thought about. We get out in the highway where the tires have to work a little bit harder, and all of a sudden we have a blowout. You know, it's one thing to have a tire fail at 5 or 10 miles an hour. It's another thing to have that tire fail catastrophically at 60 or 70 miles an hour. So have the tires inspected. Make sure they're in good shape. If the car feels like it's just not performing as well as it should, you're driving down the road and the steering wheel's just off-center a little bit, it's pulling to one side or the other, that's an indication either a tire problem or a wheel alignment problem. In your introduction, you said, how do we know when you need a wheel alignment? Pretty much everybody who drives in New England needs a wheel alignment yearly to try to make up for all the potholes and things. But certainly irregular tire wear can cause part of that. All the fluids in the cars, you know, people get a little bit lazy in the cold weather and they don't check all the vital fluids like oil, transmission, engine coolant, power steering fluid, brake fluid, to make sure it's all at least topped off. It might not be in the best condition. Maybe you haven't quite gotten into getting the car in for service, but still that's no excuse to drive around, you know, with your engine oil down a quart and a half worth of oil because no one's opened the hood to check it, or transmission fluid that's a little bit low. And the other thing is any other kinds of damage that could happen. You know, we get a nice day here or there. It's a good time to go out, you know, wash and wax the car, clean it up, see what it looks like. That's going to give you a good time to be able to inspect the car, see what kind of shape it's in. If you wash it and wax it, you burn about 1,000 calories. So,
1,000, that's scientific, right?
Yeah, that's right.
John, thanks so much. We do have to go to a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Goodwill Northern New England, with a 10-year goal of helping 10,000 households build stable lives through work. GoodwillNNE.org. And Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
Few places in the world are as closely identified with dance as a theater in the heart of Moscow, the Bolshoi.
There is no other ballet that can offer such variety, such high quality of performances as the ones at the Bolshoi Theater.
We sit down with a Bolshoi prima ballerina, Olga Smirnova, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
Hey, it's Ray from Car Talk. You know, a lot of people have an old car they'd love to get rid of. But get this, one generous Maine Public fan donated a 38 Nash Ambassador. Somehow it managed to slip through my claws, and I'm ashamed of myself for that. But it generated cash for the station. That old car has been turned into Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and lots more. Good work, Mainers. Keep those cars coming.
Visit mainepublic.org and click on support.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answers to your car maintenance and car shopping questions. With me today, John Paul. He is master mechanic and spokesperson for AAA Northeast, also known as the Car Doctor. Jamie Page Deaton is auto editor for U.S. News and World Report. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll start in Tamworth, New Hampshire with Brian, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a 03 Toyota Tacoma pickup. It's got 150,000 miles on it, well-maintained. And my mechanic just started to see some small cracks in the frame. Now, these pickups were recalled when they were manufactured in this date. I didn't get a recall, but I was wondering if it was worth pursuing Toyota for help in getting this frame fixed.
John?
Oh, I think it certainly is. Even though yours wasn't maybe in the recall list, I would still talk to them about it and see what they have to say. I know there has been some exceptions outside of that window of what was considered part of the recall. The problem is, depending on the car and the other overall condition, what they're going to find underneath, when they have to do a major, if it's actually starting to rot through and crack, the only real repair for that is to remove the body, take the frame off, put it all back together, which includes having to disassemble fuel lines and brake lines, exhaust system, and anything that attaches to the frames. What can sometimes happen is when the repair gets to be that extensive, it's all those other things that have to be replaced that get pretty expensive that you have to pay for, because that wouldn't be part of the recall. So I guess at this point, what I would do is have a Toyota dealer at least take a look at it. If it's isolated to one spot, you can get frames repaired. I mean, it was something that back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we used to do a lot of. And it wasn't unusual that you have a frame that was rotted away. You would go out, you'd cut a bunch of the metal out, you'd weld and fabricate up a piece, weld it back together, and get it back. To a point where it is safe enough where you felt good about driving the car. The idea of having to replace a whole frame, anybody who ever worked on a 60s Chevy would never even think about doing that. They would just cut out the rotted frame, put it back together. And there are people that really specialize in that. Usually they're real professional welding shops that have lifts that can do additional work. It's usually not a body shop or something like that. It's usually a welding shop. So I think at this point, have it evaluated by the dealer, see what the dealer has to say. Once they've looked at it, then call Toyota Customer Assistance. Tell them what the dealership found and let them know, I know it's outside of the warranty, or I know it's outside of the recall, but is there something we can do to try to make my car safe so my 15-year-old car doesn't have to be thrown away?
All right, Brian, good luck to you. And thanks, John. We'll go to Doug, who's calling from Montville. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I've got a question for your experts. We bought a brand new 2018 Subaru Outback, and we intend to keep it for quite a while. And I'm wondering, what is the latest on undercoating? What are people doing? In the past, I've put fluid film underneath my car. I had it done at a service center. So I'm just wondering if the fluid film, or if there's a better undercoating, or maybe even do nothing. So that's why I'm calling, and I'll take my answer off the air.
John, that's a question that comes up every show, especially with Subarus. What do you say?
Well, my Yankee frugality says you don't do anything. You just try to keep the car clean. My big concern, and there are years ago, there used to be all kinds of different undercoating products, Z-Bart and Rusty Jones and a lot of those. And what's good about if you do add that kind of product to a brand new car, at least you're not trapping moisture in there. If you took the previous caller's Toyota pickup that's 15 years old and try to undercoat it, then you'd just be trapping moisture under the undercoating, between the undercoating and the frame. On a brand new car, less likely to do that. The good news is, on a brand new car, today's cars are really rust resistant in a lot of cases, different than when Subarus first started getting popular. There used to be kind of a joke that you could actually hear them rusting away on the showroom floor. That's not the case anymore. They're pretty resilient to rust, and I think if it was my car, and I'm someone who keeps cars for a long time, I would just try to keep it clean periodically after the roads are salted, and you kind of get the roads cleared up a little bit, get under there and try to hose off any accumulated salt, just so you're not adding to the problem. And other than that, don't worry about it and drive it for 20 years.
All right, there you go, Doug. An email from Patricia. My 2005 Saab 92X, which I love, has just been given a death sentence. I'm looking to get a good used car for around $12,000. I'm looking for better gas mileage, good visibility, safety, and reliability. I only drive about 10,000 miles a year and am 66. Any suggestions? What do you think of a used Kia Soul? Any other suggestions? Jamie?
Well, I was actually thinking the Soul until she said good visibility. That one, it's got good forward and outward visibility, but then when you want to back up, visibility could be a little bit better. That's also when you're talking about gas mileage. The Soul, because it's shaped like a brick, really doesn't get the best gas mileage compared to, you know, some other small cars. The $12,000 mark, though, you still have some good options there. If you're thinking about a Kia, go ahead and take a look at the Kia Forte. This is a small car that Kia put out. It comes with a lot of standard features, so a used model also comes with a lot of standard features for the money. The nice thing, too, is Kia has some excellent warranty coverage, some of which is transferable when you buy one used. So like their super long powertrain warranty, I think, is transferable from the original owner to one more owner after that. So you'd still be covered for up to 100,000 miles or 10 years, whichever comes first, if you go with the Forte. Other ones that are worth looking at, if you want something that's got a little bit higher up, take a look at the Hyundai Tucson. Hyundai and Kia are related companies. So the Tucson is a good, inexpensive, small SUV, good visibility, good gas mileage, good warranty coverage as a used car. And it really is, you know, a decent option, you know, for the money. Other ones to look at, too, though, would be if you can find a decent used Honda Civic, that would be an excellent choice as well.
All right. We have an email from Patrick. I have a 2008 Nissan Altima, and I've been having problems with it for the past 6 or 7 years. During the hot weather, when I drive about 70 miles or more, it will not go faster than 50 miles an hour. I've taken it to the dealer twice, and they are unable to fix it since it only happens on hot days on a long journey. John, any thoughts?
Well, first off, he's a very patient person if this has been going on for 6 or 7 years now. More than likely what's happening is there's one of the sensors is obviously starting to have a problem with the heat. And there's some ways that a good technician can look at that. You don't have to go out and drive the car 100 miles to try to simulate the problem. You can get under the hood and under the car and heat things up with a heat gun and see if you can look at things like oxygen sensors. The thing that was missing from the email was, when this happens, does a check engine light come on, for instance? That could be a clue. One of the other things that can happen is we have seen some issues where the, strangely enough, the brakes actually apply slightly. And they apply slightly because the brake light switch is actually misadjusted. And for some reason, over time, it actually causes the brake light to just or causes the brakes just to stay on just a little bit. And if you drive long enough, the brakes are going to get hot enough, and it's going to cause the car to start to slow down a little bit. So the first thing I would start to look at is the obvious things, like let's look and make sure the brakes are working the way they should, make sure the brake light switch is operating properly. There's even a technical service bulletin that came out about the brake pedal switch way back in 2014 that references a lack of power sometimes. So that's one of the things to look at, but also don't give up on your repair shop saying we can't look at it because we're not going to drive it for 50 or 60 miles. There are some things they can do to try to get the car hot, or at least try to get the sensors hot that could be part of that problem. And it could be they have to put some diagnostic tools on there, be able to measure things like fuel volume and pressure to make sure the fuel system is working okay, as well as even things like the exhaust to make sure that the exhaust is working properly. A partially clogged up catalytic converter, which can happen when the car starts to get hot, can also restrict the performance from the engine, and that will make it feel like the car just doesn't have any power anymore. So don't give up completely. You're very patient that you've been waiting for as long as you have to try to get it fixed, but I think there's some ways around it. First off, start with the technical service bulletin. If your garage has access to ALLDATA or Mitchell On Demand or some of the other technical databases, go in and look it up. It's an easy one. It's an easy fix, and it could be as simple as the brakes actually applying themselves, and you don't even know it.
We have an email from Becky. First, I'm wondering if you can discuss leasing versus buying. Second, we have a 2002 all-wheel drive Volvo with 200,000 miles and showing many signs of age, as well as and a small two-wheel drive 1997 Nissan truck. We are looking to retire both of these and instead get a small, comfortable truck with four doors. I use the truck for my work spring, summer, and fall, and the car in winter for pleasure trips. We are looking for a small truck that would work for both of these needs. We live on a mile-long dirt road, so it must be all-wheel drive or a 4x4. We have always bought second-hand vehicles with many miles on them and would like something more dependable as we are nearing retirement. This is why we are considering leasing. We'd greatly appreciate any recommendations. So, Jamie, I think they're looking for a recommendation for a truck and for buying versus leasing.
Yeah, buying versus leasing, I mean, this is a question that I think a lot of people have. And the thing to remember with buying versus leasing, if you're leasing a car, your monthly costs are going to be lower, but your long-term costs are going to be higher. That's because you're going to always have a car payment. If you go from one lease to another lease to another lease, you'll always have a car payment. It might be slightly lower than what you'd have if you'd paid if you'd financed a car. But when you finance a car, if you finance a car for 3 years, after 3 years, you no longer have a car payment, and you can drive that car for another 7, 8, 9, 10 years without a car payment. Whereas if you're leasing, you're going to have a payment for that entire period. Now, that said, if you're looking for something and dependability is really important to you, if it's really important to you to have the latest, most up-to-date safety and entertainment features, then leasing is really one way to get all that stuff at a much lower cost, because when you're leasing, you're only paying for the portion of the car's depreciation while you have it. So if you're leasing a $50,000 car and it's going to, at the end of the lease, be worth $30,000, you're only paying $20,000 for it. But just remember, you're going to always have a lease in those kind of $20,000 chunks as opposed to buying a car and keeping it for the longer term. So it really just comes down to, do you care more about your month-to-month costs and having the latest and greatest, or do you really care more about your long-term kind of financial goals and eventually not having a car payment for, you know, a period of time? That said, if you're thinking of leasing, truck leases right now are incredibly cheap. They are some of the best leases out there. In a lot of cases, you can get a full-size truck for under $300 a month, which is just absolutely ridiculous when you consider, the amount of space and power and features that these trucks have. Now, that said, Becky, you mentioned that you wanted a small, comfortable truck with four doors. Nobody's really making a small truck anymore, but I think the best option that you should look at would be the Honda Ridgeline. This is a truck that can do a fair amount of hauling and towing, and you didn't mention that you had anything specifically, you know, big and heavy to haul and tow. And if you have a small two-wheel drive Nissan truck, the Ridgeline is going to be able to more than handle the work that the Nissan truck was doing. And it's also, it's for long car trips, it's very car-like. It's got a great back seat that's got plenty of room for adults. It's not like those trucks you see where people are really just kind of shoved back there. The front seats are very comfortable. The ride compared to a lot of other trucks is very smooth. And what I really like about it for long road trips, for me, trucks are difficult to deal with on long road trips unless you've got a tonneau cover for the bed. Well, the Ridgeline has a lockable in-bed trunk, so you can put stuff in there and lock it and not have to worry about, you know, rain or wind or somebody stealing your stuff. So that's one really good option. The other one that I would take a look at, I think the back seat is a little bit less comfortable and the ride's a little bit less comfortable, but the Chevrolet Colorado is another good option. It's not by any means a small truck, but it is the smaller of, you know, the two trucks in the Chevy line. And you can get, you know, a model that has, you know, a more comfortable ride that's not off-road oriented, and still have a lot of, you know, good comfortable features and good reliability. And they also have pretty good leases on them if that's something you're considering. The other thing with the Colorado too, if you decide to buy, Chevy does usually offer 0% financing for up to 6 or 7 years on those trucks. So you might be able to at least save on interest if you go that way.
All right. Well, good luck, Becky. And we do have to take another quick break. Before we do so, a word about tomorrow's show. Please join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about inventors in Maine. Email us your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Collins Center for the Arts, presenting The Bible Abridged from the Reduced Shakespeare Company, March 24th. Tickets at collinscenterforthearts.com. And the Natural Resources Council of Maine, hosting a forum on climate change and national security with Senator Angus King. More at nrcm.org.
Later today on This American Life, there's this border wall in Africa that's more like an obstacle course than a wall, really. It's created what seems like a bizarre and pretty dangerous sport, where people on the African side get together in big groups and basically rush this obstacle course, storm it, all trying to get over it once, any way they can. People spend years trying. One guy tells us what that's like later today.
That's coming up this evening at 11 o'clock.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times editor Jonathan Weissman tells us about becoming a target of neo-Nazi trolls on Twitter, who barraged him with anti-Semitic insults and threats. In his new book, Semitism: Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump, he wrestles with how to respond to white nationalists and looks at connections between them and the Trump campaign and administration. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all things automotive. On the line with us, Jamie Page Deaton, auto editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, a spokesperson for AAA Northeast and a master mechanic. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Norridgewalk and Philip. Hi, Philip. Go ahead.
I've got a couple questions that you touched on earlier. One of them pertains to the autonomous cars, and the other one about the automatic braking system. On most vehicles, well, any vehicle for that matter, parts are prone to fail. In computer systems, systems need to be upgraded. There's catastrophic failure. There's rebooting all this. On an autonomous car, is there likelihood you could be riding down the car, down the road in a car, and the system fail, for instance, because of an electrical problem or something that shorts out the computer system, and the car would veer to the right or left or stop or do whatever? What's the chances of that?
Okay, Philip, yeah.
Computer systems are...
John, this is part of the conversation that's going on, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, and that's one of the things people are concerned about. What happens when your, you know, robotic driver all of a sudden stops doing what they're supposed to do? And if it's like any other, and the problem is nobody really knows yet. That's the real answer. But if it's like any other feature in a vehicle that has some level of automation, it reverts back to the standard what we've always known. Now, someday when there's level five vehicle autonomy and you might get in a car and it has no steering wheel and it has no brake pedal and it just has a big red emergency button that shuts it down, that's a different story. But the vehicles that we see today, whether it's something like the Tesla Autopilot, if you get to the point where that system doesn't work anymore, it's just going to revert back to a normal system. It's not going to tend to, you know, make the car swerve one way or the other. It's just going to sort of shut down and the car is going to go back into manual drive mode. That's what we're seeing. That's what we see with, for instance, if the Volvo S90 has a pretty good, some people consider it level two self-driving system. I was driving that car in the snow last year. It was snowing pretty miserably, and the system just shut down. It shut down because the sensors and the sensor array in the car just couldn't handle the inclement weather, and the car goes back to, well, now you have to learn how to drive again. And that brings up another point. That's sometimes what people more of the psychology of life look at, that, well, what happens if your self-driving car drives 80% of the time and you have to drive 20%? Do you get rusty at driving? And that's a real fear, and that's a fear today in the airline industry, where most of the time when planes are flying, they're flying on autopilot, not the actual pilot driving flying the vehicle.
Philip, thanks for your question. We'll go to an email from Joe. Should I or should I not purchase the extended warranties on new car mechanical engines and transaxles and computer components? Jamie, it can be dizzying when you buy a car, all that's being offered to you. How do you choose which to take and which not to take?
Yeah, I tend to pass up on the extended warranties. But the thing, you know, the math that I tend to do with it, too, is, you know, look at your level of comfort with risk. Look at the history of reliability of the brand and the model that you're buying. And then look at what's covered with the extended warranties. I think everybody's kind of worst case scenario is you spend all this money on an extended warranty and then something breaks and you find that it's not covered. So it really just comes down to you having to do the calculus for yourself. I tend to not buy them just because, for one thing, you know, the cars that I buy, like, I tend to buy from fairly reliable brands. The other thing to remember, too, is, you know, in my mind, and this kind of goes back to our earlier question about, you know, undercoating, you know, automakers are putting the cars out in the world after extensive testing, and, you know, they're not going to send a car out there to rust. You know, Subaru heard the jokes that you could hear Subarus rusting away, and then they fixed the problem. And so I think cars today are, you know, more reliable than they ever have been. And so I would just probably, you know, I tend to skip it, but that's a level of risk that I'm comfortable with. And who knows, it might come back to just bite me later on when I have to pay all this money for car repairs. But here's the thing, too. You know, if I've driven a car for 5 years and it's out of its original warranty, and something breaks, I tend to approach it as, well, you know, it's a five-year-old car. Stuff's going to break on it. And, you know, I've set the money that I would have spent on an extended warranty. You set it aside. Use it for repairs if you have to.
We'll go to Larry calling from Brooksville. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I thank you all for this conversation. I was told to be concise. We are Subarus, as you were just discussing. And going back to your previous discussion, we traded in a Forester 276,000 miles for a new 2009 Impreza. Well, we got a notice, a recall notice for the airbags. We took it in to have the airbag taken care of, and as a result of going in and taking the airbag, taking care of that, they found that the main wiring harness had been all chewed up by mice, by rodents. Come to find out that somewhere along the line, 2005 or whatever, Subaru made the decision to, instead of coat their wiring with the plastic, for whatever reasons, they went with a soy-based product. food for rodents. So $2,000 later, fortunately our insurance covered it. We had the airbags done, but we've also got a brand new wiring harness, which took 2 weeks back and forth trying to get parts in and that. And come to find out, too, that apparently from what the insurance company said and what the dealer said, this, don't be surprised. This is common. We get this all the time.
Interesting. So, John, is this something you've heard of?
Oh, it is. And a lot of vehicle manufacturers have switched from a petrochemical-based, so an oil-based wire insulation, to a more environmentally friendly soy-based insulation. And in fact, soy-based in a lot of things, foam cushions and things like that inside cars. And it is food for rodents, unfortunately, to the point where Honda has actually come out with a mouse tape. So it's a type of a almost like an aluminum sticky tape that you wrap around the wiring harnesses that apparently doesn't taste good if you're a mouse and you're chewing away on things like that. So if I had that problem, I would probably consider getting a roll of mouse tape and trying to tape up what I could see at least. The other thing is try to look at why you have mice to start off with. And, you know, if you have birdseed, dog food, someplace where you keep the car parked, all of that could attract rodents, which could look for, you know, more to eat, which is the wiring harness in your car. So try to separate anything that you keep. If you're fortunate enough to have a garage or a barn you keep your car in, make sure that you don't have standing water that can attract mice, food that can attract mice, things like that. You know, if your car has to share a garage or a barn with mice, I don't know, get a cat.
All right. Larry, thanks for your advice. We have an email from John. We currently tow an 800-pound camper using our 2013 Honda CR-V, and it works fine, except we experience a lot of road noise inside the car when we drive long distance on the interstate. Can you recommend a smaller mid-size vehicle or truck that can tow lightweight but gives a quiet ride? Jamie.
Oh, this is, you know, it's not just people who tow with their Honda CR-Vs. This is a constant complaint about the CR-V, is just road noise. And Honda as a brand in general just seems to have a road noise problem where their cars are just a little bit louder on the inside than everybody else's. But I think there are a number of quieter, midsize, slightly larger SUVs that you should be considering. Number one would be the Ford Edge, which is a great midsize SUV, and it is so quiet and so well insulated, very nicely finished. Another one to look at, too, would be the Nissan Murano, which is, again, you know, it's got the ability to tow that small camper and is very, very quiet and hushed on the inside. Ones that I would stay away from, though, I found that along with Honda, Toyotas tend to be a little bit loud, too. So if you're thinking about going, you know, from a CR-V over to a RAV4 or to a Highlander, unless you're going for the upper trims, and the Highlander is Toyota's midsize SUV, unless you're going for one of the upper, more expensive trims of the Highlander, the lower trims tend to be a little bit loud, too. So if you're trying to avoid road noise, look at the Edge, look at the Nissan Murano. Those are two great options.
All right. We have an email from Stev. Along the lines of the undercoating question, does driving through puddles to wash off salt do anything positive or negative, or am I just having fun doing it? John?
I think that falls into when you were a kid and you ran in a puddle and jumped up and down. You have to think that puddle that you're going to drive into, someone else already did, so it's already salty water and contaminated. The right way to wash off salt residue is clean, fresh water. You know, look for a nice day, get out there with the garden hose, wash as much as you can. Car washes do a pretty good job, but they recycle a certain amount of their water, so I really like to do it with clean, fresh water when I can. That's the best way to do it. But like we pointed out earlier, today's cars do a really good job of keeping a lot of that corrosion at bay with a lot of the different materials that they use today, where they coat the bodies before they're assembled, coat the subframes before they're assembled, and keeps them pretty rust-free. But, you know, if you like to drive through puddles, as long as you do it, and I'm not a pedestrian nearby, I guess it's okay.
Question from Fred. Why can't we get manufacturers to provide us with right-hand side vehicles? Postal carriers have to purchase their own vehicle, and there are not good choices. I have to purchase old Jeep Wranglers because there's nothing else available. Jamie.
Yeah, it's just a cost factor. It's not profitable for them to sell right-hand drive vehicles here because really the only people who need them are postal carriers, which is not a huge segment of the population. So it's just, they're just not going to sell them here. But there are a number of cars I know, because we actually had a question on our site from a mail carrier several years ago asking, hey, are there any cars that you can drive from the passenger seat? Because I'm a mail carrier and I'm looking to do that. This is not something that I necessarily recommend, but it's something that I've started thinking about, too, with test cars, cars that you can drive from the passenger seat, you know, where there's not that much space. And what you're looking for there, because I'm not recommending this, so I'm not going to give specific names, but I have reached over and tried to do it with some of them. Compact cars work really well for that. So look for something small, like the Wrangler. The Wrangler is not particularly wide. That's one where you actually can drive it as long as you get an automatic. You can drive it for short distances, maybe around a neighborhood from the passenger seat.
An email from Clarissa. I recently purchased a 2009 BMW X5 from my son. I have never owned a cool car before and thought it would be fun to own one. It needs an O2 sensor. Does this car require premium gas? And how much does the O2 sensor repair affect the mileage? The mileage at this point is not good, which I expected, but it is really not good now. John?
Well, I think, what was the car again? Was it an X5?
Yes, 2009.
Yeah, and more than likely, it does require a premium fuel. It's a premium fuel car. And the big question is whether it is premium fuel required or premium fuel recommended. And that's where the real question becomes. Because if it's premium fuel recommended, you can get by without putting premium fuel in. What you may see is a bit of compromise in the performance, the overall performance of the car. You might even see a little bit of a drop in fuel economy, but you're going to save it at the pump. If it says premium fuel required, and it will say that right on the gas door when you open up the gas door, that's a car that you have to spend the extra 40 or 50 cents a gallon to put premium fuel in. This car uses four different oxygen sensors. So depending on what's really wrong with it, the average price of an oxygen sensor in this car is about $310. One of the sensors is $305, one's $320, so figure about $310. Depending on how many sensors it needs, you're going to have to step up and replace them, and you're looking at a couple of hours labor to replace all the oxygen sensors. So this could turn into about a $1,600 repair by the time you're done.
Wow. All right. Good luck, Clarissa. We're going to go to Janet and Kennebunk. Janet, we're almost out of time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
I just have a quick question about the Prius.
Go ahead.
I just have a quick question about the Prius.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I have a 2014 Prius, and it's got about 89,000 miles on it. I've heard that the battery can go bad and that it's very expensive to repair it.
Okay. So, Jamie, do we know how long Prius batteries last from the 2014 era?
No, I don't know about the 2014 era, but I do know that the batteries do get extra warranty coverage. So if you're at 89,000 miles, you're probably still covered under the battery warranty. So take it, you know, take a good look at your warranty, talk to your dealer about it. But I haven't heard anything about, you know, massive battery failures of Priuses.
Same with you, John?
Yeah, same with me. In fact, my testing of Prius batteries and hybrid batteries, I ask cab drivers whenever I see them in a hybrid, and I say, how long do you get out of the batteries of these things? And usually about 300,000 miles, sometimes up to 350,000 miles. So you have plenty of time, nothing really to worry about. And as we see more and more hybrids, especially something as popular as the Prius, the batteries are available in remanufactured and aftermarket replacements. The prices are coming down a lot.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, Janet. And that will be our last question this hour. Always a popular program. And thank you both to our regular favorite car experts, Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, master mechanic, spokesperson for AAA Northeast, the car doctor. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and everything else at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.